missed it. You know, I missed what was right in front of me.
You're listening to award-winning filmmaker Dream Hampton in a moment of startling vulnerability. Hampton admits that when she authored a profile about R&B megastar R. Kelly back in 2000, she'd noticed the very young girls in his entourage. But she dismissed it.
I missed it. You know, I missed what was right in front of me.
This mistake troubles her, and it's part of why she said yes to creating the 6-part docuseries Surviving R. Kelly, which premiered on the Lifetime Network in January of 2019. The series features the distressing testimonies of young women who allege they'd survived appalling physical, mental, and sexual abuse by the artist.
There's a difference between R. Kelly and Robert. R. Kelly is this fun, laughing, loving guy. But Robert is the devil.
Kelly is accused of videotaping himself having sex with an underage girl.
Taking advantage of minors will not be tolerated.
Jurors found him not guilty on all charges.
Robert has said all along he would be clear to these terrible charges.
Shame on you!
Shame on you!
Shame on you!
Shame on you!
Milk R. Kelly!
A little more than a month after the series premiered, this happened in Chicago, Illinois.
Kelly has been indicted by a grand jury on 10 counts of aggravated criminal sexual abuse against 4 alleged victims.
5 months later, it was this.
The R&B singer found himself in handcuffs once again last night when he was arrested while walking his dog outside of his Trump Tower home in Chicago. He is facing a 13-count indictment in the Northern District of Illinois, including charges of child porn and obstruction of justice. And there is a separate sealed indictment in Brooklyn that we should learn more about later today.
And then on Monday, more than 3 years after Hampton's series shook the music industry, we got this news.
In one of the most prominent trials of the Me Too era, a federal jury has convicted R&B superstar R. Kelly on all counts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and on today's episode of The Takeaway, we begin with the artist and activist Dream Hampton. Dream Hampton is the showrunner and executive producer of the docuseries Surviving R. Kelly. Dream, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Melissa.
You were the first person that I emailed yesterday when I heard the verdict. How did you learn about it and how did you feel?
I've been doing this wonderful thing where I have been leaving my phone in a drawer while I run errands. And so I came back to it and I guess it was around 4 o'clock and there were 30 messages, and I was stunned. You know, I remember 2008 and I remember his acquittal. And I can't say that any of this I expected. Maybe some other people associated with production did, but you mean making Surviving R. Kelly about a 50-year-old R&B singer who hadn't had a hit in a decade and whose predation had been an open secret for nearly 3 decades, I didn't expect that there would be charges. I didn't expect there'd be trials, and I certainly didn't expect a conviction.
Let's go back to your decision to pursue the story, to tell the story. Why that story then, especially given, as you just said, 50-year-old R&B singer hasn't made a hit in a minute.
You know, I really messed up. In October of 2000, so that means this is back when there were magazines. I must have gone out to Chicago in July or August if it had a street day of October, November. I did a cover story of R. Kelly. In fact, the photo of that cover story became evidence in the 2008 trial about him. And it was a profile. It was a profile about his habits, about how he worked in the studio. And I missed the real story. You know, there were young girls in the studio, but that wasn't something that I hadn't seen before. I was in the studio when Puff was working with Total. I was in the studio when Mary J. Blige was just out of high school singing backgrounds for Father MC. Like, I've been in studios before, and I missed it. You know, I missed what was right in front of me. And about a month after the cover story that I did about R. Kelly in Vibe magazine was released, Jim DeRogatis began his reporting about Tiffany Hawkins, a girl who went to the police, Chicago Police Department, as a post-teenager and alleged that R. Kelly had abused her as a minor. And that article became evidence that this Aaliyah marriage, which had happened when I profiled R. Kelly and which I'd asked him about during the interview, he got very defensive and seemed surprised that I would even ask him. But that became evidence that this wasn't some weird spring, winter love or whatever euphemisms we have for predation, you know, that there was a pattern to his predation. Shortly after that, of course, a video came out of him sexually abusing a 14-year-old who turned out to be Sparkle's niece. And so I felt like when I was invited onto this project, this wasn't my idea. I was hired to be showrunner and executive producer of this. I couldn't say no. I knew that it would be secondhand trauma, that it would be difficult. I knew that we were in a new landscape. I wasn't really thinking about Me Too. In fact, I was thinking about the way that one is so easily trolled and doxxed in this moment. And so all of those things were nothing compared to this duty I felt to, I don't know, right or wrong. And also I'm from this generation, you know, and I was around and I was in this business as a music journalist when he was getting away with all of this. And so I just owed it, you know, to these survivors to do the best job that I could do.
Who else owes these survivors? Who else missed it either through actually missing it or by choosing to turn away from it?
I mean, well, we can talk about kind of the ecosystem of enablers, you know, and that is exists on a corporate level. It exists amongst his peers. On a corporate level, there was a lot made of the fact that John Legend was the only celebrity in surviving R. Kelly. And I did an interview early on. I think it was my very first interview about the docuseries. And I was asked why he was the only one. And I named all of the people that I'd invited who didn't come on. And that became a headline. And sure, I'm not backing off of that. I did ask those people and I asked them for good reason. But who I wanted more than his peer celebrities were the people who ran Jive Records, for instance, his record label. Barry Weiss called him several times trying to get him to come on camera. People at that record label, he had a hand-picked few women, quite frankly, who he would only work with. I don't know, I asked Stephen Henderson, who was responsible for producing BET's award shows and who gave him almost 12 minutes to perform this epic kind of homage to Sam Cooke years after, we'd seen a tape of him raping a 14-year-old. I wanted all of these people to come on camera, not to have a gotcha moment, you know. I wanted Jay-Z to come on and talk about, you know, as a 50-year-old man to reflect on, you know, the decisions that he made to make a record like Not Guilty with R. Kelly, to go on tour with him after he was, acquitted. And some of those reasons might have been really pedantic. It may have been that they had a contract to do this tour and he would have been in breach of contract, which he ended up being anyway when they canceled it. But, you know, I wanted to hear some of these explanations and I wanted people to be willing to possibly be reflective, and they were unwilling.
Your point about maybe it was just a contract. There is the banality of evil that Hannah Arendt, of course, warns us of, the ways that we can all participate in it, even if we are not enacting it, we're enabling it. And I wonder if, in addition to those who owe the survivors and those you've named here, those of us who consume the music, those who even right now are in social media saying, well, but he's a genius. What do we do with a musical genius who is a serial sex abuser and a pedophile?
You know, I don't have the answer to this question, but I can tell you it doesn't begin with or end with R. Kelly, right? I know that the women who began Mute R. Kelly hoped to not just deplatform him, but the boycott and sanction and most importantly, the divestment was about stopping income from coming, from flowing towards R. Kelly, mostly live concerts. Is where artists are earning their income and have been for the past decade. And that money was directly responsible for the staff that, you know, R. Kelly told which girls would eat on a particular night and who wouldn't, who was on punishment, who was disallowed from coming out of the studio room that he'd locked them in and was disallowed bathroom privileges. So there was an operation. This is why he was charged with a RICO charge, right? There was an operation, a criminal operation, that your concert dollars were flowing directly towards your funding, right? But this question about art versus artist is a test that I failed personally. I'm able to turn away from R. Kelly, even though I do think he is probably the greatest R&B singer of my generation. Well, besides Mary J. Blige.
I was like, are we about to do this conversation? Because no, we could have this Mary conversation.
J. Mary J. She wins. But I wasn't able when Pearl Clegg wrote Mad About Miles after Quincy Troup's autobiography with him came out. And we learned about the kind of serial abuser he was. I may have been successful of a Miles Davis boycott for a couple of months. And then I fell in love and I was listening to Miles Davis again. So I have not passed that test all of the time of separating the art from the artist or boycotting an artist because of their personal terrible behavior. I would like, if people are unable to, you know, stop listening to R. Kelly, stop streaming him, then I would like these music companies, the Spotify's and the other companies, to establish a fund, the restitution that's going to be necessary to begin the healing journeys for these victims is mammoth. And we're hearing reports that he's broke, that he has a negative income. So, if you can't stop listening to R. Kelly, let that money go towards his victims.
Let's talk about the survivors. We've been talking about Kelly, but let's talk about the survivors. Obviously, not only did you provide this extraordinary and extremely painful to watch series, but you were in the room, you encountered, you engaged, and undoubtedly made choices about what we would see and what we would hear. Can you talk to me a bit about that process?
You know, I've been thinking about the process a lot lately, and I've been thinking about And this may, you know, be a conversation for some other place, but I've been thinking a lot about what documentary can do and what it can't. You know, first and foremost, the studio was interested in protecting itself from libel, from being sued, from litigation. And that meant that while we had lawyers who were policing my interview questions, making sure that they weren't leading, making sure that they could stand up as a transcript and say a lawsuit, we didn't have therapists on the set. You know, we didn't, that investment wasn't made. And these women were reopening wounds and trauma and reliving that for my cameras for hours under hot lights. I mean, we would take breaks and then they needed them often, but none of the survivors, and I interviewed every one of them and their parents, none of them sat for me for less than 4 hours. Mm. It was necessary, you know, for me to play a role that, quite frankly, in this, you know, in the world of sexual victims and crimes, I was charged as a producer on this to play the prosecutor, you know? And prosecutors aren't my favorite people, which means that I was required, if someone told me a story that was awful, I was required to say, to ask the same questions detectives ask, for instance, like, who else did you tell about this and when, and may I have their contact? Like, I had to do all of the kind of verification that we think is happening in the criminal justice system. And that's not a role that I'm proud of necessarily. I would have much rather reached out to them as a survivor myself, as a Black woman, as a sister. But that wasn't the role that I was charged with doing on the set in order for this project to make it to television. Does that make sense?
Oh, it does. And as I listen to you say it, I wonder how you surviving R. Kelly, how you, as a survivor, as a mom of a daughter, how you made it through day to day.
Well, I had something that not one of the women that I interviewed had, which was a history of engaging in therapy, you know, and some resources to take care of myself. You know, they were my own personal resources. We don't get rich making documentaries. I don't know if that's a surprise to people. but I did have this history of knowing how valuable therapy was. So I immediately, you know, put myself back in therapy. I wish that we could have done that for the survivors. Whatever secondhand trauma I experienced was nothing compared to them having to relive this for the cameras, knowing that they'd be opening themselves up for derision, knowing that in this social media age where they all have accounts, most of them public, that you would see the kind of comments that you saw even on Geronda Pace's Instagram yesterday, you know, they're still being trolled. And that never feels good, you know? So I made it through, but I wasn't the most important person on the set. And by the way, yes, I had to do all of the interviews and hold these stories, but everyone was affected. Our sound guy, you know, this like white guy in his early 30s had never heard anything like this. Everyone who worked on this project, the women who had to pre-interview the victims from the team, they had to hold these stories. So everyone was affected.
Why do you think we care so little about the assault, the abuse, the actual missing Black girls and women? Why is it so easy for us to literally look at it happening to them, to watch it on video, and to make a story that it's somehow their fault?
Yeah, that's a hard one, you know? And growing up Black and female, this isn't a new story to me, you know? It's not a new story. There's a legacy of Black feminism that I certainly didn't make something as amazing as Ntozake's, you know, For Color Girls, or as strong as Alice Walker's Color Purple. And those are just two examples, you know, from a particular generation. Black feminists been taught us that this cognitive dissonance is, you know, something that we have to struggle against. Our impulse to protect Black men often outranks any, you know, notion that we'd have to care and love for not just Black girls and women, but, you know, Black children. I mean, R. Kelly he's victimized people on a gender spectrum. And by the way, R. Kelly himself was a victim, you know? And there is this way that we fail, and it's not disconnected to white supremacy. It's not disconnected to a criminal justice system that has framed innocent Black men for sexual crimes. We know this history, it has been written about, and it seems like we have to start at the beginning every generation. And that to me is exhausting.
Now, I was moved by Hampton's willingness to be vulnerable about messing up and missing the signs of Kelly's predation. I have to say, I felt that too. When I first moved to Chicago in late 1999, I started an educational enrichment program for high-achieving juniors at Kenwood Academy High School. Now, as a newcomer to the city, I didn't know that it was the same high school R. Kelly attended as a student. But I got to know the dedicated leadership there, the terrific students of the high school. So many of those young people from that program, I'm still in contact and relationship with them. But back then, I started to hear rumors and warnings. People saying, Professor Harris, make sure you know where your kids are at all times. Make sure you're counting heads in the programs because sometimes he comes by. Now, what I and the entire city learned in 2000 is that the he was R. Kelly. That year, Kelly faced charges of sexually assaulting a 14-year-old student from Kenwood Academy High School. And that was more than 20 years ago. And like Dream Hampton, I carry a certain weight, a guilt, a knowing that we all knew that there was this open secret of abuse swirling around us. But honestly, I think most of us felt helpless. We weren't lawyers. We didn't have the kind of evidence that you could take to court. So feeling helpless to stop him, we just drew the children closer to us. We sought to protect them with our vigilance, with our care. But of course, we know that for decades, there were always just enough who slipped beyond our fingertips, beyond our arms, and through the cracks. And they became vulnerable to Kelly and to his abuse. Let's keep going now with Dream Hampton. Now, Dream, you mentioned Alice Walker, Ensisoke Shange, Toni Morrison, bell hooks. It's a reminder that we're not just survivors as Black girls and women. We're also creators. We're not just the sum of all the horror that is occurring to our bodies and our minds and our souls. You're a creator, and I'm constantly finding you backstage at events that I didn't even know you were producing. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your joy projects. When you're doing work that maybe feels a little bit less like Black girl salvation and a little bit more like just Black girl magic.
Yeah, I think you remember me backstage with a headphone set on the set of Black Girls Rock, where I got to work with Regina King this year at the Oscars. Steven Soderbergh invited me onto his team, and that was like so great to figure out in this moment where Derek Chauvin had just been convicted, like how to keep her buoyant and also have some, you know, to be in the moment. And so, you know, I'm built for this. Like, I'm okay dealing with the darkness in my work. And I don't know that if you were to look at my resume, that there'd be much evidence of joy, but in my real life, and you know, you've been to my dinner parties. I like to cook for my friends.
Food and the music. My husband, Jim, would be like, have you been listening to this playlist? This is amazing.
Yes. I will be up until 3 a.m. curating a playlist and trying to figure out, you know, what appetizers would be great with what main dish I'm serving. So, I mean, that's the life that I'm living, and I'm trying to create some pleasure and ease in it. I began my career as, say, a writer by calling out Dr. Dre for abusing Dee Barnes. So there has been like heavy lifting and hard work, and maybe that'll change. I'm doing a piece right now for the LA Opera that is about the opposite of that. But I don't get that many opportunities to do that. And it's not because I'm more courageous than anyone else, but it's because I'm willing to do that dark work. And I don't know that that'll change, but I'll continue to have good playlists and great dinner parties, even as I do this work.
Dream Hampton is a filmmaker, activist, and executive producer of the docuseries Surviving R. Kelly. Dream, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
And we also wanted to hear from you, the community of The Takeaway. And here's what you told us about your reaction to the guilty verdict.
Hi, my name is April M., and I'm calling from Horicon, Wisconsin. And unfortunately, it took forever. But, you know, when things like this come to light, it's good to see justice. Feeling bad for the victims, of course.
Hi, this is Jennifer. I'm calling about the R. Kelly verdict. To me, it should have been done 20 years ago. He's been grooming girls ever since Aaliyah. To me, how he rots in jail the rest of his life. I am a rape survivor, and To me, this is finally a victory for us, and we deserve this. And finally, it shows money does not help everything. And to R. Kelly, I'm glad you got caught. And to all the victims, I hope you get the help you need.
And Aisha sent us a tweet saying, quote, well, it's about time. Regardless of their skin color, too many rich men have been getting away with so much ish. As I'm typing these words, many young women are being sexually abused just for wanting to start or advance their career. It's an ongoing issue. Thank you for tweeting to us, for calling us. It is always so good to hear from you guys. Now remember, send us a voice memo with your thoughts at takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Stars at night are big and bright, deep in the heart of Texas, Texas.
Back with you on The Takeaway, I'm Melissa Harris Perry. Now join me on a little trip down to Texas. San Antonio, Texas. Now here's a few quirky facts that you may not know. Did you know President Lyndon Johnson married his wife, Lady Bird, right there in downtown San Antonio? Did you know that Fritos were invented in San Antonio? And of course, the five-time NBA champion San Antonio Spurs, well, they're actually the only former ABA team to win a championship in the NBA. One more fact. San Antonio's police department has the highest rehire rate in the nation. Right. Okay. So rehire is when a police officer is fired for something like excessive use of force or domestic abuse, but then is rehired because of union required arbitration. Having the highest police rehire rate is not the kind of statistic a city uses to advertise its quality of life. And in San Antonio, there is a grassroots organization fighting for change. Act 4 SA. Ananda Thomas is the executive director of Act 4 SA and the former deputy of Fix SAPD. Now, last May, Fix SAPD campaigned for Proposition B. That was a measure to replace the current police contract with one that would allow for accountability, transparency, and voter engagement. Now, the Prop B initiative failed to pass, but the margin of defeat was so slim. So now, those activists are reactivated, and they're determined to act for San Antonio. When I spoke with Ananda, I asked her why policing matters are so important to the residents of San Antonio, Texas.
San Antonio is a majority Latino city, but very, very diverse. They say we're Military City USA. A lot of veterans come to retire here. We bring in a lot of diversity. But you know, our police contract and our police union really kind of laid the groundwork for police contracts all across the nation. And specifically, we have an issue with having one of the most unaccountable contracts that has led to us having the highest rehire rate for fired officers in the nation at almost 70%. And that's due to our contract.
Okay, so you're going to have to walk us through this step by step. So first, what do you mean a rehire rate for fired officers? If you're fired, why aren't you just gone? Peace out. You're gone.
Right. So just like exists for many unions, officers are allowed to appeal their firings. Here, it's through a process called arbitration, where they use outside arbitrators to look over the decision from the police chief to decide subjectively if the firing or disciplinary action was too much or not. And so there's several options here. When an officer is fired, they can appeal, use an arbitrator. It either goes through an arbitration process, which is very costly and takes a lot of time and resources from the city, and the arbitrator can overturn the police chief's decision, or the police chief and the arbitrator and the officer can have a settlement agreement outside of arbitration to speed up the process, which often results in the officer being rehired.
How long has this form of the union contract been in place?
Since the 1970s. It was brought in through a ballot initiative that had about 2% of the total voting population vote before we even had single member voting districts. So representative voting through city council districts.
Okay. So you've got a police contract that means that, well, actually, let me back up for a second one more time, just so I'm making sure I'm getting all of this right. When officers are getting fired, typically, or do you even know from the data, typically, what kinds of actions are causing them to be fired?
So this is for general misconduct, something that is not criminal or has gone to court. So some of these actions are for excessive force, domestic abuse. We had a case of an officer here who tried to give a homeless man a dog feces sandwich. Fellow officers turned him in. He was fired. Due to loopholes in the contract, when he went through arbitration, he was allowed to be reinstated. And often these officers are reinstated with back pay because of the time they have spent off of the force.
Okay. So you have a contract in your city that's been in place, what, nearly 50 years now, that allows an officer to basically abuse the people he's supposed to be or that she is supposed to be protecting and serving. And because it's so expensive to do a public process, then basically there's not accountability that the public can even know about?
Correct. Also, because our contract has restrictive rules on officer files, we, until recently, have not even been allowed to view the arbitration cases themselves. So we can find out the result of an arbitration after it's happened, but nothing that happens in the process in between the investigation, the recommendation from our civilian review board to the chief, none of that is accessible to the public. So it has not been a transparent system for decades now.
Okay. But what I love about the reason that you're here to talk to us, Ananda, is because you didn't just sort of look at this, you know, obviously huge problem and say, oh, well, I guess it's that way. You've been working to change it. Talk to me about the campaigns that you've been involved in around altering this contract.
Yes, absolutely. So under Fix SAPD, we really started taking a look at our police contract. And we have two local government codes here that establish our contract. One is Chapter 143. That was brought in through ballot initiative in the 1940s before most of us could vote, right? Heavily Latino city, Black people couldn't vote, Latino people couldn't vote. And that sets up municipal civil service laws that are commonly referred to as a law enforcement bill of rights. Hiring, firing, discipline, sets limitation on investigations, helps establish arbitration. The other chapter is Chapter 174, which also was brought in through ballot initiative, and that establishes collective bargaining rights for our police union, but more importantly, establishes that anything in the contract can supersede local and state law, giving a further bubble and shield from any type of accountability legislation that the city or the state would want to pass on officers.
Wait, how can a union contract supersede law? I mean, really, like, technically, how is that even possible? I can't simply write an employment contract that says, by the way, I can do this thing to you, even though it's illegal in the state?
Correct. So the idea behind it was that if they wanted during negotiations to establish stronger discipline or accountability or amend certain rules, like creating less restrictive officer personnel file rules, that they would be able to do that. But on the other end, on the other hand, it can also allow them to put up barriers and shields to laws that would establish better transparency and accountability. So it has created this slippery slope, something meant to be a tool for justice and accountability being used as the complete opposite.
Okay. What was Proposition B?
Proposition B was a ballot initiative to remove Chapter 174. Now, originally, we were collecting petition signatures to remove both of these chapters. However, Chapter 174 only required 20,000 signatures as a cap, while Chapter 143 is based simply off a percentage of the amount of registered voters in the city with no cap. So that's currently closer to 80,000 signatures in San Antonio. And, you know, was unattainable during our first go around, but we absolutely plan to go after that again. But this would remove the collective bargaining rights for our San Antonio Police Officers Association, meaning the contract is null and void, and they would have to create a new contract under a meet and confer law, a different chapter, which would allow us to finally have a larger say in the creation of that contract and create one that allows for more accountability, transparency, and absolutely stronger police discipline.
All right, so I'm going to listen to a clip of John or Danny Diaz, who's president of the San Antonio Police Officers Association. He's speaking here to News for San Antonio and has a somewhat different perspective on it. Let's take a listen.
We have over 600 officers that have 20 years on or more that could retire. That's not including the young officers. There's no guarantee that the city's going to give us the same pay or even less. We're at the city's mercy. Same thing with the insurance. They're taking away insurance. We don't know what the city will give us.
Okay, so is that accurate that the work that you're doing here around accountability could also lead to a mass exodus of police who might retire and also might, you know, leave them without insurance, which does not seem fair?
This is part of the tactics that police unions have used for decades here, a scare tactic for voters. There's no evidence that officers would leave in droves without a contract. The city has no incentive to not hold a contract with great benefits, with great pay for officers, because public safety is such an integral part of our system. And, you know, the 600 officers he's talking about that are eligible for retirement, that's any given year. Many officers and folks in other industries are up for retirement and choose to stay for whatever reason. So it was just a false claim that officers would leave in droves if we lost collective bargaining, because suddenly the city would try to not pay officers or give them insurance, even though they're city employees. There's no basis for this. We do have other cities under meet and confer in Texas. They tend to have more officers per capita and the same or better pay and benefits. That's what the facts and the data and the evidence show.
So why not want to go to meet and confer then? What is this that is it simply about being able to be protected even in the context of bad acts?
Yes, the collective bargaining rights do set up a negotiation process that will favor the police union always. It grants them more power. And a simple difference really between collective bargaining and meet and confer is collective bargaining requires both parties to meet, where meet and confer, the parties must choose to meet. But there is never a time where a city would not meet with their police officers association or police union when these are needed services around the city that we rely on so heavily.
So you didn't win this time. What did you learn?
Yes. You know, we learned a lot about fighting disinformation from our opponents. We learned a lot about being able to take these complex issues and topics of collective bargaining and contracts and legislation that is pages and pages and pages long and condensing it in a way that is digestible to your everyday voter. And we learned a lot about resources. The Police Officers Association here ran a $1 million campaign against us, a grassroots organization that had not even been around for a full year yet. One of our founders didn't even know who her city council member was until she became active and involved and looked into this. And they poured resources and disinformation into this. We've definitely learned that we need to go heavier on fundraising, but also just that voter contact and using the narratives of folks that have been abused by police or lost loved ones here, you know, amplifying those stories, because it does get the hearts and minds moving. And I absolutely think we can do this next go around.
Now, if you don't live in San Antonio, but you're kind of looking to the city for advice or strategy or hope, what can other people learn from your experiences?
Do the research. We spent about 3 months before we ever collected our first petition signature. Every state, every city, every county is different on petition rules. Whether it's notarizing every page of a petition or the language that needs to be on there, walking through these laws to fully understand them, to be able to put it into digestible sound bites. And we learned a lot about coalition building. I highly recommend that anybody trying to do this or similar work reaches out to community partners, organizations. It really does take a village to take on the power structures that exist everywhere we live, and to just be brave. We faced intimidation throughout the campaign. So I also would like to amplify the need to have those safety protocols in place, and just know that if you're agitating someone that much, it's because you are doing the work and you are right where you need to be.
Ananda Thomas is Executive Director of Act 4 SA. Thank you for joining us today, and promise me that you will keep us up to date on what happens next.
I absolutely will. Thank you so much, Melissa.
On Tuesday, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation announced this year's 25 recipients of the so-called Genius Grants. This year's cohort is an incredibly diverse group of people. 12 women, 13 men, 11 of the fellows are Black, 6 Latino, and 1 Asian American. And that diversity also cuts across ability, geography, and so much more. Like in previous years, the work of this year's fellows reflects a breathtaking array of scientific, scholarly, and cultural contributions. Taylor Perrone is a geomorphologist working at MIT, trying to understand the mechanisms that create landforms on Earth. Jacqueline Stewart is expanding the public imagination through her groundbreaking archival work on Black film. And Monica Munoz Martinez is a public historian excavating the history of racial violence along the Texas-Mexico border. Listen, there's a reason that MacArthur Fellows are colloquially referred to as geniuses. And we're joined now by one of this year's MacArthur Fellows. Desmond Mead is a civil rights activist and executive director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition and author of the new book, Let My People Vote. Desmond, it's so great to have you here.
Melissa, I am thrilled to be with you today. You just don't know. You know, I got to say this, you know, this recognition started with you many years ago when you named me a foot soldier.
Okay, don't make me cry. We got live radio to do. Listen, MacArthur grants are often called genius grants, and I'm wondering how it feels for you to be called a genius.
This is so surreal, you know, and I hear you talk about the diversity, but another distinction of this year's honorees were that two of us, myself and Reginald Dwayne Betts, were formerly incarcerated people. Right. And I think it's so amazing that, you know, people like me and Reggie are getting the recognition and the platform to really elevate, you know, the work of people who are closest to the pain.
You know, I'm thinking about that and this way that if you say genius just out in the world, folks often think of like a scientist, right? And sometimes they really are, right? Or a mathematician, right? Kind of sitting alone in their office doing work and, you know, people who had straight A's in school and followed all the right paths and had all the right outcomes. But one of the things I love about this class of fellows is genius is so collaborative. Your genius is, in fact, in organizing, in moving people, in changing systems.
Wow. You know, I'm still trying to process this, Melissa. You know, just to say genius next to my name, I mean, well, I'm still in awe. You know, I remember back in the days, I used to tell people that when I first got my law degree, I told them I had to do a doctorate degree, a doctor in law and a doctor of the streets. You know, and I just, you know, this is like surreal to me. I'm like I said, I'm still processing this, but I am extremely grateful because this is an amazing opportunity to really elevate the work that's being done by formerly incarcerated people throughout this country.
Tell me about some of the restrictions that so many formerly incarcerated people continue to face, the things that you are barred from accessing even after having served time.
Let me tell you, I could use myself, you know, and I write about it a lot in my book. But, you know, even though I was able to overcome so many obstacles, because back in August of 2005, I stood in front of railroad tracks waiting on a train to come so I can jump in front of it. You know, recently released from prison, homeless, addicted to drugs. I didn't see any light at the end of the tunnel. But the train didn't come, and I was able to overcome all these obstacles to eventually graduate law school and obtain a Juris Doctorate degree. But because I had a felony conviction, even to this day, I still cannot practice law in the state of Florida because I can't even sit for the Florida bar. And believe it or not, after all the success that I've had, I still don't even own a home because a lot of HOAs have provisions written within their bylaws that would restrict me from even owning or renting a house, you know, in the state of Florida. And so there are so many collateral consequences that people like me face. And then to me, I think the biggest one is being prevented from participating in democracy. But at least we were able to overcome that barrier by successfully passing Amendment 4.
Now, tell me what Amendment 4, remind folks what Amendment 4 does and the effect that it may have in coming years.
Yes, so Amendment 4 basically was a constitutional amendment in Florida that restored voting rights to people with felony convictions after they had completed their sentence. And our efforts had an immediate impact on 1.4 million people in Florida. And so Florida being such a critical state in federal elections or presidential elections, right, this amendment have the opportunity to significantly shift the political landscape, not only in Florida, but in this country. You know, for many years, people say as Florida goes, so does the rest of the country. And, you know, with the exception of last year, you know, that's been true. And so to be able to re-enfranchise a significant number of people in a state in which presidential elections are typically decided by, you know, 100,000 votes, sometimes less than that, was very significant.
Earlier in the show, we were talking about R. Kelly, who is often seen as, and I think rightly, as a musical genius. And we've talked a little bit about how that framework of being great can also cover over and paper over and allow people to turn away from bad actions and actions that hurt others. So I'm wondering how you think about that responsibility of carrying something like activist or civil rights activist or genius and how that reflects in on the responsibility we have that goes along with a title like that.
Well, you know, I fully embrace whatever comes with being named a genius and that responsibility, especially as a person, like I said, where I've come from being homeless, addicted to drugs, and contemplating suicide. And so I took on that responsibility long before MacArthur awarded me this honor, because I believe that, you know, that I was chosen, that God chose me to do a work. And that work was to really, number one, just show people there's so many folks in our society who are facing obstacles and who, you know, looking seemingly, you know, feeling like there's no light at the end of the tunnel. And what I do with my body of work and who I am as an individual is a message to them that no matter what obstacles are in front of them, that they could overcome those obstacles and have an impact in their community. In addition to that, and equally as important, you know, this body of work that I'm engaged in also shows people who may not have walked a mile in my shoes that they cannot automatically foreclose on a drug addict. They can't automatically foreclose on the returning citizen or formerly incarcerated individuals, and that they could see what happens when we're giving, people like me are given second chances, knowing that we have the potential to be a great asset to our communities. And so this was something that I took on many years before getting this recognition. And so I fully embrace the responsibility that comes with being named a genius today.
As you're talking about that opportunity to use your talents, your gifts, your abilities, your second, you know, law degree or your second PhD, the one that you earn in these much more tough circumstances. I think you and I have talked about my older brother before. He's 9 years older than me, and I hadn't seen him in about I have not seen him face to face or touched his hand in more than 20 years. And we recently lost a family member, and I did not know that he'd been released, and he showed up at the graveside, and I saw my brother for the first time in 20 years, the first time that we've all been together, all the siblings. And on, you know, whenever I see my brother, I think, God, he's so tall, he's good looking, he's funny, he's smart. But I know that's not what so many employers see. I know that's not what so many landlords see. What's the work that gets you off the track? The track in front of that train. How do you see yourself?
So let me tell you. It is so amazing that you shared that story again about your brother. Because here's the deal. You know, I remember just a couple years ago, I was one of the 100 most influential people with Time Magazine, right? And I remember telling one of the executives there that they missed the mark because they put The Rock on the cover of Time. Right. And I told them that they should have put me on the cover because, you know, I think folks need to know that you don't have to be a movie star, a celebrity, an athlete or a billionaire or a politician to have an impact on this world. Right. That if they could see that a drug addict, a convicted of multiple felonies could overcome those obstacles and have an impact not only in this community, but on the world itself, that they can do it, that we all have what it takes to actually do something great while we're here on this planet. But the other part of that is also showing, and speaking to what you're saying, is that employer, right? Today, that employer who is hesitant to hire a person with a criminal past, right, could look at me and say, man, would I be denying Desmond a job working for my establishment? Or the landlord, you know, that is hesitant, or these cities or municipalities and police departments that have these crime-free housing policies that are so inherently racist and discriminatory, right? Would they now rethink that because they see someone who their policies would say, you're not allowed to live here. You're not allowed to work here. You're not allowed to go to school here. And you're not even allowed to vote, to have your voice heard. Right. And so this moment, I think, is a moment to really elevate that platform to help start shifting some narratives. Right. Because what you saw in your brother is what everybody should see in your brother first. And that is his humanity. Right. Not the mistake that he made, but his humanity. And when we're able to connect with each other along the lines of humanity, we treat each other more humanely. And we understand that some lives are not more valuable than others, that we're all deserving of being treated with dignity and respect.
Have you thought about what you're going to do with the money?
You know, at the end of the day, you know, I think where my blessing comes from is when I take the blessings that God give me and use it to help others. I've done it before in the past with our fines and fees fund, where we're helping people pay off fines and fees so they don't have to choose between putting food on their table or voting. And I will continue to do so because God always blesses me when I put people first.
Desmond Mead is a civil rights activist and executive director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. He's also author of the new book, Let My People Vote, and a certified genius. Desmond, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Have a great day.
Before we go, we have a transformational takeaway for you. Now remember, these are the short stories we'll be bringing you about people who are making transformational changes in their communities, in our country, and around the world. Today, we're leaving you with the story of Betty Reed Soskin. Soskin is a park ranger, and earlier this month, she celebrated her 100th birthday. A resident of Richmond, California, Betty Soskin was in her 80s when she got involved with the planning of the Rosie the Riveter Memorial Park near her home. As a Black woman who'd worked during World War II, Soskin felt her story was not reflected in the planned park. So she became a consultant to the park, and then at 85 years old, she became a park ranger. Her role is transformative because, as Soskin often says, quote, what gets remembered is determined by who is in the room doing the remembering. Which is why it's worth mentioning that if the Congress fails to raise the debt ceiling and the government shuts down on Friday, national park rangers like Betty Reed Soskin will be furloughed. The parks will be closed, and there will be no one in the room to remember. The debt ceiling crisis is manufactured, but the consequences are real. You can learn more about Betty Reed Soskin and check out our podcast at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.